Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from Relator in Bay Area Citizens Against Lawsuits.
May it please the court, Mr. William Pearson is the argument for Relator. Relator is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Members of the court, Will Pearson, Myra Morris, Chester Mikowski, for the Bay Area Citizens Against Lawsuits. As the court knows, we're here on a petition for writ of mandamus, but it involves two very important questions. Two of the questions that I believe are of great interest to the citizens of the state. Of course, the easy question is the First Amendment. The second question that is equally important to my clients' interest in this case is whether or not there is jurisdiction in this case over the Bay Area Citizens Against Lawsuits. The reason that is important, particularly the jurisdictional issue, is my clients face a trial on February the 23rd of this year over issues that we do not believe the trial court or the real parties in interest, the plaintiffs, have the right to bring.
Why should we address that issue by mandamus?
The court, of course, Justice Phillips wrote in Walker versus Packer that mandamus is an extraordinary remedy. And I believe, under the circumstances, that a trial court has no jurisdiction, no discretion, when it makes determinations on issues of law. And the reason that that issue is important is there are citizens of Nueces County, as well as the trial judge, that will undergo a trial in this case when there is no standing for the plaintiffs to bring this issue to begin with.
How about the city charter?
The city charter was determined in 1935 in the city of Corpus Christi, ex-relator Harris versus the Plato case, to only give right of the taxpayers to bring suits to enjoin the payment of money in the future if the city itself does not do that. And I think that it's important in this case, Justice Spector, to understand that the city of Corpus Christi is not complaining about what it is that Bacala has done or not done in this lawsuit. And not once have the plaintiffs, the real parties of interest, gone to the city and even applied and asked the city to bring this lawsuit. So I believe in answer to...
You're saying they wouldn't because they're not satisfied.
That would be my viewpoint. And I think that the city charter and the cases that then construe the citizens' rights throughout the state say that there is no right to do so in the past. And I think it's important to point out that the evidence before this court in the record will be, number one, Bacala does not occupy any of those premises as of April of 1997.
But that was after the city trial.
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
Do you see a difference in this case on the jurisdictional issue, say from the Walker versus Packer scenario? Do you see a difference in cases where a party's constitutional rights are at stake, and if you have to go through the trial process and the appellate process, then you won't be able to put those constitutional rights back in the bag?
I would agree with you, Justice Abbott, because, of course, if our donors are discovered, then the cat is out of the bag.
Because our time's limited, let's just stay on this first issue for a moment and come back to, you say there's jurisdiction. Answered me because first the trial court had no discretion to commit a legal error, which of course would mean we would have roughly 3 or 4 million mandamuses a year. And then you say somebody would sue that had no right to sue and it would be a useless act. But we've held in Canadian helicopters that that alone doesn't give you right to seek a mandamus. What can you divine from our cases that would let you challenge the mere fact of standing at this point prior to the development of a trial record?
Justice Phillips, I was told to anticipate that question from yourself that perhaps there would be a concern about a flood of litigation. I believe that in the CSR opinion that was written by Justice Spector, and I believe in that particular opinion, Justice Baker, called upon the legislature in a special appearance context to change the law and allow an interlocutory appeal. And that was in fact done by the legislature. And I think what I can call upon before the court is some extraordinary circumstances, such that the court could tailor such narrow relief in this case that it would not invite the flood of litigation that perhaps you're concerned about. I am not a practitioner before this court on a regular basis, certainly, but I would be willing to gamble and say that there are not very many of these types of cases, if any, in the entire state of Texas.
Well, how would you craft this relief?
Number one, depending upon how the court wishes to go, I believe that this court can establish or decide that under these circumstances, the taxpayers have no right to seek what it is that they're trying to do. If the court then decides...
So you're going to make a taxpayer standing exception then? Is that how you would characterize it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that exception, if it is such an exception, already exists because the taxpayers have no right to...
No, I'm talking about in terms of bringing the issue before the court on mandamus. How would you characterize? You say we could be able to carve a narrow remedy here where we wouldn't open the floodgates on legal questions being presented by mandamus.
Well, of course, certainly it exists in the jurisdictional context to begin with. And I'm willing to bet that not very many of these types of mandamus appeals involve a jurisdictional issue. There is no other way for my client to present this issue to the court.
Why won't an appeal suffice?
Justice Owen, number one, of course, in the First Amendment context.
Assuming we were to grant relief and deny the access to your donors, and there was no issue of membership being disclosed or amounts of donations, why wouldn't an appeal of the so-called jurisdictional issues be enough, be adequate?
Yes, Your Honor. The fundamental issue before the court is, if the taxpayers, the plaintiffs, do not have the right to do this initially, an appeal will put other taxpayers to the expense of the trial. It should be pointed out to the court, as is in the record in this circumstance, that a visiting judge has been appointed to hear this case, Judge Robert Gardner from the Rio Grande Valley. And so I believe that we will be back before the court, again stating that taxpayers do not have jurisdiction, the right of standing to bring this lawsuit. And I believe that the court can take judicial notice or see the very harm that is being put upon my client, by Calla, by having to go through this lawsuit. And perhaps if I could go back and answer Justice Hankinson's question, and it will satisfy you, Justice Owen, is that this lawsuit is the epitome of harassment, because if the plaintiffs wanted to fashion relief, and if the court wanted to fashion relief, they would go to the city of Corpus Christi, which is the source of the money, reportedly, the public funds, or they would go to the Alliance. And what they have done in this case is give the Alliance documents, their financial records, which do not show any payment of tax money to anyone. And they've asked for our records, which we've given them. And that has not been satisfactory to the plaintiffs in this particular case. And so I do believe that it is one of extraordinary circumstances, because the jurisdictional question does not involve the calendar. We are not a proper party to this lawsuit, just like the plaintiffs have no right to bring it. And so I do believe it is an extraordinary circumstance. And I know what the cases say about that, that it is an unusual circumstance. But the CSR case, I warned, that was written about an asbestos manufacturer from Australia, certainly could not anticipate that it was going to be hauled into court some 30 or 40 years later. Just like my clients have no interest or concern at all about what goes on in the Alliance building. We didn't then, before the lawsuit was filed. We don't now. If the deed reverts to the city of Corpus Christi, my clients do not care about that.
What kind of showing do you say the law requires you to make order to keep from having to divulge your supporters and contributors?
Well, I believe that the ex parte Lowe case decided by the Supreme Court in 1994 that involved a group that I would suggest is slightly more unpopular than DeKalb, said that all my clients were required to do was to invoke their First Amendment rights, which we did in this case, and then the burden of proof would shift to those seeking that information, the plaintiffs in this case. And we believe that we have done that. But if the court were to disagree and say, well, DeKalb, the burden is upon yourself to bring forth this information, we've also done that. We had an evidentiary hearing.
Does a corporation have a First Amendment right?
Justice Spector, this was not briefed, and I apologize for that. But I would cite to the court the First National Bank of Boston case versus Bellotti, B-E-L-L-O-T-T-I, from the Supreme Court of the United States in 1978, which said, yes, corporations do have that same right.
Under what circumstances?
Under the circumstances of the Fourth Amendment, I'm sorry, the First Amendment as applied to the states through the 14th Amendment. It is that very circumstance, and again, I apologize for not having that in the brief. But when
maybe you can furnish that to me.
Well, I wish I had enough copies. I'd give you one right
now.
The site of that is 98 Supreme Court, 1407. That was decided in April of 1978. And I would suggest that the reasoning is sound in that case. And the reason it is sound, I believe that if the court starts making distinctions within the First Amendment, for example, a popular versus unpopular group, or a corporation versus an individual, that would not be what the First Amendment or the Texas Constitution, which gives broader rights in some circumstances than the First Amendment itself. That would not be a good distinction to make, in my view.
It's something else. The organization that you're representing, does it come under in any way, the election code disclosure requirements, where they're, as a PAC would be, or?
Yes, Justice Spector, I understand what the court is asking. The plaintiffs attempted to inquire early on whether or not we were political lobbyists, therefore would come under the election code. We are not. We're a nonprofit corporation existing under the IRS code 501c6. We do not have those same types of requirements because we don't engage in those same activities.
You're not a political committee under the terms of the law.
No, Your Honor.
You say that we shouldn't start making distinctions between people on their First Amendment rights.
Yes, sir.
But the federal courts speak repeatedly of a serious infringement of associational rights. If a group is universally popular, so that people are clamoring to join it, there seems to me there'd be no infringement. Don't we have to look at that? Or is that word serious just something they threw in to make the test sound better?
Well, I can't speak to what was in their minds at the time, but I certainly do not believe that it is a wise, reasoned decision to begin making those types of distinctions. The court itself may have differing views about the roles of citizens against lawsuit abuse associations within the state. There are a number. Depending upon what part of the state you're in, they may be popular or they may be unpopular. In Corpus Christi, all the court had to do in 1994 and 1995 was drive up and down the highway and see the billboards that were in opposition to it, or the television commercials that were equating the organization with a very far-right organization.
So does every nonprofit corporation have an absolute First Amendment right, trumping the statute or anything else, have an absolute First Amendment right to keep its membership secret from those who it desires to keep it secret?
I would say yes, based on the NAACP versus Alabama case, based on ex parte Lowe by this court. The reason that that is so important in this case is because the disclosure of the membership list have absolutely nothing to do with what it is that the plaintiffs seek. They seek to enjoin the payment of tax monies. That means where the money goes from the city.
Are you asking us to set aside the First Amendment and just rule that this is irrelevant and issue a mandamus on those grounds?
If I understand the question, the court is asking me whether or not I would like the court to rule upon the jurisdictional issue?
No. That's a new question.
All right.
You said this is so important here because it's irrelevant to our case. And I'm asking, are you asking us to look at the mandamus just on that ground, the relevancy?
No.
Versus zero. So if there wasn't a First Amendment tinge to this, you wouldn't be here.
No, I don't agree with that either, because I believe that the court needs to look beyond just the circumstances of whether or not the First Amendment is involved. There is serious harm being caused to my client, an organization throughout the state that may be perceived as unpopular, an organization that set about to change the citizenry view of the judicial system and the legal process.
The other side would call, would characterize it as an organization designed solely for jury tampering.
Justice Gonzalez, of course, they've made that argument, which is why the harm is so evident by what is happening to their government.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Davis, I'll move
to argument. Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honor. My name is David Holman, and I represent six Corpus Christi taxpayers who are real parties of interest in this case. McCullough may perceive he has suffered some serious harm, but if that is so, it is a self-inflicted wound. McCullough voluntarily chose to operate as a nonprofit corporation under the Act, which subjects it to a public disclosure requirement, that is, it is required to publicly disclose all financial records.
Let's talk about that.
All right.
In your briefing, there's heavy emphasis on the word all, but I don't recall emphasis on the words financial records. Where is there a definition of financial records?
There is a definition in the earlier part of the statute. In Section A, it says the corporation shall maintain current, true, accurate financial records with full and correct entries made with respect to all financial transactions of the corporation.
And why would contributors or contributions be categorized as a financial transaction?
Yeah, I will answer that. And let me correct something that the ACLU has presented in its amicus brief. First, it says that the legislative history suggests that he was only concerned with the spending of funds, and therefore we shouldn't be concerned with how the funds were received. Although there's nothing in the legislative history to say that that wasn't also a concern, they focus on that. In that statute also, Section A, it says, with respect to all financial transactions of the corporation, including all income and expenditures. So they were concerned not just with the spending practices of nonprofit organizations.
So it's your argument that under that statute, because it says they're concerned with income, that you also have to reveal who gave you that income.
Exactly. You have to reveal all your financial records. There's no other way to read that statute.
And that would be true for every nonprofit corporation in the state.
Every nonprofit corporation that qualifies under the statute. The statute was narrowly written to only address those nonprofit corporations where there had been perceived problems. Other organizations, other nonprofit corporations, say those that had members and solicited from their membership, those that had contributions from the public of less than $10,000, schools, hospitals, alumni associations, and so forth, they exempted out of that public disclosure requirement.
I hate to parse this too finely, but I think probably from an accounting point of view, a contribution would not be categorized as income.
I'm not an accountant, Judge. I just read the language of the statute, and it clearly says that all financial records, including all income and expenditures, and if I'm looking at income, I'm looking at how the money was received. And that's part of the financial records, in my view.
Does the NAACP have to disclose their membership list?
Well,
Texas chapter?
I don't know if they qualify under the statute, Your Honor, but I think that there's a...
If they did, would they have disclosed their membership and donors?
I think it depends on what kind of showing they made. I think they made the same kind of showing that was made in NAACP versus Alabama. I think there could be an argument made that the First Amendment would prevent them from doing it.
What our showing argument, do you say?
Well, our argument is that if you choose among different business entities, in our case, they chose to be this nonprofit organization that was subject to the public disclosure requirement. That was a voluntary choice they made, and they made that choice so that they would be exempt from certain taxes. They could have chosen to be a corporation.
Back to my question. What kind of showing would the NAACP have to
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you.
Circumvent the statute.
Okay. The showing would have to be objective and articulable facts, showing a well-rounded fear of economic reprisal, loss of employment, and public hostility. That's what the case says itself. And that showing was established in the Buckley versus Vallejo case, in which contributors to minor political parties were trying to say, well, this violates our First Amendment rights to require the candidates to disclose us as contributors. And the court said, well, you only have one or two contributors that are complaining. You have a speculative, the showing is a highly speculative showing. That's not enough to show a serious infringement on First Amendment rights.
Is our low case inconsistent with the showing in NAACP?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and this is why Lowe says throughout that if you're talking about a matter of federal law, as a federal privilege, you apply federal law. And they said that it was properly raised in that case. And I assume that what they meant, what the court meant in Lowe, is that by properly raising it, that doesn't mean just the mere assertion of it. That means following the steps of establishing privilege, which means you not only plead it, but you have to establish the privilege. And then the burden would shift. A good case to look at for the court on this regard is the Dole case out of the Ninth Circuit, the 1990 case. And that case goes through the history of the showing requirement under federal law, talks about Buckley, and talks about the different cases. And it says that if they haven't made the sufficient showing, then the burden never shifts. The burden doesn't go to the other side to show that there's a compelling state interest because there's no showing of First Amendment harm for a compelling state interest to overcome.
Do you think Buckley contemplates a weighing consideration of the reason for the disclosure, which was protection of the electoral process, versus the kind of interest that was First Amendment interest that was asserted?
I believe you could read Buckley to report that requirement.
And that's why they said that a minor party might be able to come in at some point and make a showing that would cast it into the clock.
That's right.
In making that First Amendment balance, does the need of the requester to help establish their lawsuit enter into that equation?
If the
material requested is either only tangentially, marginally relevant, or not relevant at all, that weighs into the balance.
But in a discovery context, all discovery is relevant unless you've shown otherwise.
But I'm looking at it solely on the constitutional issue.
Yeah.
Because this court hasn't had a habit.
This
court has not made a habit of looking at discovery that is not burdensome to produce and reversing it merely on relevance.
Exactly. And I don't think it's a situation where if they have no showing, you have to show a great need and it works that way, or that as their showing increases, you have to show a greater need. I think it's they have to have sufficient evidence to show that they have been harmed, and then the requirement is to show that there's compelling state interest to overcome that. It's not a seesaw kind of deal where you look under various scales of whether the need is... It's whether they, if this court finds that they have established sufficient evidence to make the First Amendment showing, then I agree. My burden then is to show that there's compelling state interest. Compelling state interest would have to show a substantial relation or a nexus between what we're trying to look for and what the evidence may be.
Well, if there is no lawsuit, do you believe, is it your position that the Nonprofit Corporation Act still requires disclosure?
Yes.
So whether it's relevant in this lawsuit is irrelevant.
Why does Tilton not apply, and I'll put it in this context, in a brief file on behalf of the real parties that doesn't have your name on it? It says Tilton differs substantially from this case because there was no statute requiring public disclosure in Tilton. My question is this, if we're dealing with constitutional issues and constitutional rights, why would those not trump the statute and therefore we apply the test in Tilton?
Well, I said in my brief, I didn't see any establishment showing Tilton would be required under federal law, so that would distinguish it. But I think it is also distinguished when there's a statute that requires public disclosure, that they voluntarily submitted themselves under. They voluntarily submitted themselves to be under that statute. And under the cases that we've cited, the Freeman versus Hiddle case, for example, which is a Ninth Circuit case also, 1994, which says that if you voluntarily choose an option that may require disclosure, then you have, in effect, waived your First Amendment rights. Also, the Pabst case that we pointed out, which is a Texas case, says that there's no legitimate expectation of privacy in records that are required to be made available to the public. And so, as regards to the First Amendment context, the statute is very important, because if they've chosen out of the various entities, they could have been a corporation not subject to the disclosure requirement, they could have been a partnership only required to disclose to their partners, they could have chosen to be one of these other non-profit corporations that has members, for example. If they had done that, they wouldn't be subject to public disclosure requirement. We wouldn't be here discussing First Amendment concern. And so those cases, the Freeman case and the Pabst case, show that when you have such a statute, there is not a First Amendment concern.
Mr. Holman, the basis for your lawsuit was an allegation that there was an illegal use of tax money because Bacala was city property. Now that Bacala is out of city property, what is the basis or the need for disclosure of the financial record?
There's a couple good answers to that, Judge. What you're asking me is what is the relevance, or are you asking me about the jurisdiction?
Both.
Okay. Let me address the relevance first. They have concentrated in their briefing upon the public funds issue. In other words, whether
that was the very foundation of the lawsuit, right. Was it not?
Well, there's another foundation of the lawsuit, and that's the property use issue. Our contention is also that the property was misused against the purposes of the original deed, and that therefore the deed should revert to the city.
Bacala could care less about that.
Well, Bacala is important as far as we're concerned in getting the records under relevant standards, because if they can show that it wasn't misused, in other words, the nature of the activity that Bacala was operating in was within the purposes of the deed, if they can show that, then they beat us on that argument. However, we can show that they're not a local public interest group as they claim to be, that they're in fact a special interest group. Perhaps supported by Iran or something. You know, we don't know what the records are going to show. But if we could show that they weren't this local public interest group that they're being alleged to be, so that it's within the purposes of the deed, then the evidence would tend to follow us on that.
How could those donor records show that?
Well, the donor records are going to show who contributed to it.
Right.
And if, for example, they get all their money from the Kingdom of Iran, or if they get all their money from the Alliance, or if they get all their money from the city of Corpus Christi, those records are very relevant.
Well, how could the discovery request
Sodom's for Corpus Christi, whatever did they make Sodom was saying?
Well, it makes a difference because of what they said in the lawsuit. They've said that they're supported by the general public. They have said that they're supported by local citizens. Their defense to this property use issue is, we're just doing this to help economic development because we're backed by our citizens.
But they're a less restrictive means.
Well, our argument, of course, is that the protective order supplies the less restrictive means.
What are we to make about the intimidation that's been alleged here, the letters and the record of lawyers writing to individuals who support Bacala, threatening lawsuits and threatening them that they're not, are you covered, are they going to stand by you and all that? In other words, trying to stifle association and Freedom Association?
That's their only showing, those letters by one lawyer, one law firm. Those letters were written in 1993. This lawsuit came up in 1997. There was no testimony about what those letters were, what those letters meant.
They speak for themselves. Very clear. The lawyer said, you know, if I didn't threaten you, I didn't mean to threaten you.
There was plenty of evidence before Judge Garza that there had been no boycott, that people were, you know, all the plaintiff's attorneys still maintained good friendships and good relationships with the people mentioned in the letter. Even the author of the letter was questioned, and he said his only concern, at least with regard to Exhibit 12, was to advise people why he wasn't making the same contribution that he'd made for 30 years, because he didn't like what they were doing with their video ads. Now, if the showing that this court is going to require is all a nonprofit organization has to show that they received a letter that somebody didn't like them and didn't want to do business with them, then every nonprofit organization in this state could qualify and could shield their records in contravention to what the legislature wanted. The legislature wanted to prevent charity fraud in both spending and fundraising activities. And if we act as they ask you to on this de minimis showing, this showing where there's been no real harm, there's been nobody losing a job, there's been no public hostility toward this organization, if on that showing, this court writes that this organization can shield all of its fundraising from the public eye, then every organization can do it. If every organization can do it, then this state is right for charity fraud. There are a couple things that I'd like to point out and address Justice Spector's question. The Bilotti case, I believe, although it wasn't briefed, and this is just from my research, dealt with free speech, does not deal with the right to freedom of association. The cases that we cited, particularly Roberts versus USJCs, which is a 1984 case, which is subsequent to the Bilotti case, that very clearly says that corporations don't have the right of freedom of association. We ask you that if you find that mandamus should issue, only to extend it to individual donors, because freedom of association is a right of personal liberty, and corporations do not have such personal rights.
But the donors have that right, don't they?
The corporate donors?
No, the individual donors who you're trying to find out have that right.
Well, if this court finds that there's been a sufficient showing that the individual donors have rights to freedom of association are seriously infringed upon,
you see, you have two points in your litigation, which is to see whether tax money has improperly been paid over by either the city or the alliance to Bacala, or whether Bacala improperly used the property when they were a tenant there. Is that correct? That's your two issues. If somebody paid money over to Bacala, it's the source of whether they did or not, that entity such as the city and the alliance, can't that satisfy that inquiry lawsuit?
We sure think so. And
so why do you need to know who gave money otherwise to the Bacala if they're not taxpayer money, so forth, in the hands of a taxpayer, an entity that gets taxpayer's money? Can't you find out whether the property was improperly used by deposing the people who were shown on the documents you did get as the directors or officers of Bacala?
I wish we could. We had testimony from Keith Arnold, who's the CEO of the Alliance, who says no public money's ever went to Bacala. Then we find out from their records that they did, in fact, go to Bacala. There was, on the convention and visitors account, there's listings of Bacala.
Well, so you find out what you want to know.
Well, not necessarily. We also deposed Kim Keith, who was the executive director.
Yes, but whether she answers or not is part of this mandate.
Not this question. We asked her if she'd ever received any public funds, and she said no. And it turns out that they, in fact, the Alliance had been given funds to them, only they had, at the hearing, said, well, these are just checks people give to us that we funnel through an Alliance check to them. But there's some real serious questions that we have as to, and that we can only get by seeing how they get their funding, as to what kind of an entity it is, how it is funded, what public funds it has received, how it operates, and why it operates in a public office space in Corpus Christi receiving public telephone service.
But does the record show they're no longer there?
Well, I don't think that makes a difference, Judge. I mean, we...
But doesn't the law also say that you can't recover past tax money that was paid? You can only stop it in the future.
Well, I think those prior cases say that, but there's a case called Bryce, which was cited in the initial brief, the Corpus Christi case, 1978, which allows you, under that second part of the provision, which says you can maintain, a taxpayer may maintain a lawsuit against the officer and the party receiving the illegal funds.
Well, why don't you just...
To recover the amount so paid.
Ask for an injunction to get both sides to not spend or take any money and be done with it.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to point out to the court. They hadn't agreed to an injunction. They just said, well, I promise I won't do it anymore. You know, and if that could be enough, that could end every lawsuit in the world. Just to have a defendant stand up and say, I promise I won't do it anymore. They have not agreed to an injunction. The last thing I would like to...
Is that part of your pleadings in the trial court?
I'm sorry?
Is the injunction part of your requested relief in the trial court?
Yes, it is.
But you haven't tried that issue.
I'm sorry?
You have not tried that issue yet.
We have not tried any of the issues yet. The other thing I would like to point out is that if you look carefully at the Kim Keefe deposition questions, which are also raised on this amendment, you will see that she has not asked one question about what is the identity of the donors. The 14 questions she was asked are, did you agree to this, a billboard arrangement at this office? Did you have an agreement with Philip Morris? Those type of questions. And I don't think that they fall within the category of what y'all are looking at. And I think it's very, I think y'all should be very careful when you go through reviewing this mandamus to look at those Kim Keefe deposition questions because, and the objections to them because there's one I noticed last night as I was reviewing that where it was just, I object. We believe that this court does not have jurisdiction to review mandamus, to review jurisdiction on mandamus, and for this court to hold otherwise, it would have to overrule Canadian Helicopters versus Wittig and Bell Helicopter Textron versus Walker.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Members of the court, what counsel just said about what Kim Keefe was asked is the reason that's what's wrong with this lawsuit, because Kim Keefe, the executive director, was not asked, did you receive any money from the city of Corpus Christi? She was never asked that question at the very heart of the lawsuit. Rather, she was asked, where does your money come from? She wasn't asked whether or not she received any from the city of Corpus Christi. That's what the lawsuit's about. And when you talk about relevancy or irrelevancy, counsel just gave the greatest argument why the First Amendment is supreme. I know nothing more chilling than to allow individuals that have no standing to come forward and inquire into your records about where your money came from, not where it went. The legislative history of the Nonprofit Corporation Act was about accountability on how the money was spent, not where it came from.
Now, what does it use the word income? Not the legislative history, but according to the arguments of the opposing counsel, he referenced income.
I would disagree with counsel on that. And I would further suggest to the court that that's totally irrelevant to the issues in this lawsuit. And although it may be unpopular in this United States to say the money came from Iran or Iraq, it has nothing to do with the lawsuit that's before the court.
In keeping track of the charity, let's suppose the charity said we spend 90% of our contributions on direct aid and only 10% on overhead, and they advertise that for fundraising. How would you ever prove up either the validity or the falsity of those representations unless you had some way of determining what the gross donations were?
And we gave them all that. We gave them our tax returns. What they want is to go beyond that and say, where did the money come from? We gave them all that. We gave them that voluntarily. They have every single thing that they need to either win this case or lose this case. And every single thing that they need, they can get from the city of Corpus Christi or the Alliance, but there's not been one deposition taken of anyone from the city. Keith Arnold's deposition, the executive director, was, we never once gave any public money to Bacala. There is absolutely no evidence of that. And when counsel points out, well, there was an accounting where some checks came in and were given to the Alliance to give to Bacala, Some of the donors do not mind revealing that they support the catalog. I'm one of them. Some of them very much mind and are very much concerned about the harassment that Justice Gonzalez speaks about. I think it is very naive for counsel to suggest that this has not been a heated issue in Corpus Christi or other counties.
Apart from this lawsuit, under the statute, what is required to be made public, in your view?
We believe that it would be the tax records such as we give to the United States government. We believe that they are entitled to examine the amount of the money that we received and how it was paid out, because that's there.
Now, are these contributions tax deductible?
Well, that's a good question. I'm sure I could ask some of the members if they are or they're not. I suggest that they're not.
So that information is not supplied to the IRS, whether particular donors contributed?
I believe if that's correct. I know I've never claimed a tax deduction for my contribution.
So, but they do prepare a tax return?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you know anything about that? What they declare and what's on the tax return?
Well, it declares the amount of your income. It declares how the income is spent, whether it's for rent or overhead or your copy supplies, anything like that that you would on a normal tax return.
But just amount? There's no...
It's amount.
Do you have financial statements?
I don't believe we do have financial statements.
Are you audited?
We have not been audited. The Alliance was audited, though, Your Honor. The audit revealed that no public monies were given to the county.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the third call, the court will say.